Welcome to Housing for Huntsvillians, the podcast, a podcast about one couple's quest to eliminate homelessness in Huntsville by August 2026.
Hello and welcome to Huntsville. This is our first, or Housing for Huntsvillians, we haven't decided. Anyway, welcome to the show. I am joined today by Mandy Kilgore, who is the Chief Goodness Officer and founder of Community of Hope. And when I first started asking about, hey, who is working on housing and homelessness in Huntsville, your name came up very quickly.
Oh, good.
Yes.
That makes me happy.
Totally. So I reached out to you right away, and it's taken us a long time to get scheduled, but I'm very excited about what you're doing. I'm excited to let people know about what you're doing and excited to talk to you about how what you're doing intersects with what we're doing.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Of course. Thanks for coming. Let's do a little overview of what Community of Hope is, like just kind of a elevator pitch. And then I want to get into your story.
Okay.
And then where we overlap, and then maybe where Community of Hope is going and how people can help.
Great. So elevator pitch for Community of Hope. It's a huge project.
Yeah.
Massive project. So elevator pitches can be somewhat difficult. Totally. But to get us going, you know, Community of Hope was founded due to a massive gap that we have in Huntsville in affordable housing, which is really where we align and intersect on a lot of different things. And we were formed to address that gap because we got frustrated. We got frustrated with not being able to find adequate housing. And so Community of Hope is a master planned community. We're replicating something that's already working great in Austin, Texas, called Community First Village. So we're not recreating the wheel here, which is phenomenal for me because it's a lot of work. We're just copying and pasting what works well from Austin, Texas to Huntsville, but we're applying all the Huntsville vibes and things that we need to make sure that it's Huntsvillian focused. Our campus is pretty exciting. We're looking initially at 150 homes. We're looking for 50 acres. Why 50 acres? Because we want to have workforce development. We want to be viewed as a working farm, a community place where people can come out and join us in a lot of different ways. So 50 acres allows us that space, but it also gives us a little bit of flex to grow if we need to. So 50 acres, we have to be in Madison County, which I know we'll get into on the zoning piece, but because of the barriers that we face as an organization in zoning and coding. For Community of Hope to be in the city limits would be phenomenal, but it's just not going to happen. So we're going to kind of bypass that and find a place that it will happen. And then 150 homes, and then we'll have like the supportive elements that our friends need. Mental health on site, workforce development on site, addiction therapy services on site. And eventually, you know, the sadder side of homelessness is that our friends are exposed to the elements for years. And so hospice is a part of that conversation. Respite is a part of that conversation. So it's really like a holistic community that addresses just about anything that you could think that our friends face as far as barriers are concerned.
What a concept of having things that people need within walking distance and living densely. I love it.
Thank you. We're excited about it.
Tell us how you got into this realm. Mm.
Yeah, that's a broad question too. And it started for me really not even in Huntsville. I was living in Huntsville, but flying back and forth to Dallas, Texas. And I was probably in my late 20s at that point, 28, 29. And for the first time ever, I had experienced and seen homelessness on a completely different scale, a larger scale.
In Dallas.
And I had never seen that before. I mean, I grew up in Southside, Alabama, which is a little town in Gadsden, which most people are pretty well familiar with. And in Southside, growing up, I don't remember seeing homelessness. I just don't. I was born in 81, so grew up in the 80s, 90s. And I remember being with my parents and never once looking out the window and saying, who is that person? Or why are they, what's their sleeping bag doing right next to them? So I didn't experience that. So when I went to Dallas for the first time, I'm like, whoa, what is this? And that's really where my heart started to, oh gosh, just have this passion for these people. And then to top it off, I was working in a dental clinic that mm-hmm. addressed homelessness, mm-hmm. that had homeless individuals coming in and getting their dental needs taken care of. And they would say things to me like, I'm here to get my one tooth cleaned for the day. And I would, it was a joke, you know, and so I would laugh, and my heart just began to open up to these individuals and wanting, yearning to know more. Why are you here? How long have you been here? Where are you from? Where is your family? Where are your parents? So that journey in Dallas brought me back to Huntsville and wanting to find our homeless community here in Huntsville. And I found them like 10 years ago in a camp by myself, driving down off the parkway, and I jumped out of the car, and my gift is to let people where they are, no matter what experiences you've found in life. So yeah, that was a decade ago, and I started serving the homeless as any other person would, blessing bags, serving food, serving hot food out of my vehicle, taking people to laundry day, coffee. I've moved camps, I've interacted with the city on why they're closing camps. There's been a wide variety of things that I have done, but through that, that's where that frustration comes back into play. Like, I got frustrated with not being able to move people into that next step when they were ready. Some people aren't ready, and that's okay. But when they're ready, where do they go? And there's still, to this day in 2024, not a very conclusive answer to where do they go.
Absolutely. You cannot solve homelessness without housing.
No.
And we don't have enough housing.
We don't.
It really is that simple.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty simple.
It's not the end of the story, but it is the beginning of the story, and it's the majority of the story.
Right.
So much to think about there. I mean, first of all, it's amazing that you cared. A lot of people see homelessness, and a lot of people even interact with extreme poverty and don't get involved. So I appreciate that you did. You know, and the point you made about growing up outside of Gadsden and not seeing homelessness, there's a myth that homelessness is caused by poverty. Well, in the United States, poverty, and when you compare municipalities, mm-hmm. poverty is actually associated with lower levels of homelessness. Mm-hmm. Homelessness thrives amid affluence. The richer the city is in terms of median income, median household income, the greater their levels of homelessness, all else equal. Mm-hmm. So the idea that if we solve poverty or we just raise wages, we're going to get rid of homelessness is just not accurate. Again, it's a housing issue, mm-hmm. which is what you see when you compare a place like Dallas, which has a much higher median income
yeah.
than a place like where you grew up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I think... Were there any other myths that you kind of saw exploded through actually talking to and working with people experiencing homelessness? I think another thing that people really don't understand is, you know, they think that these people are choosing homelessness. They think that these people are just fundamentally different than they are. Mm-hmm. Whereas in my reading and experience, it's an issue of precarity. And we're all a lot more precarious than we like to admit. You know, homelessness could genuinely happen to all of us, right? Yep.
Anybody.
Right.
Yeah, totally. And it, you know, a lot of things that we find and reflecting back on Community First Village in Austin, Texas, Alan Graham is the founder and the CEO there, and he says something that's pretty profound, that housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. So back to that whole aspect of like having this community come together and really work side by side with people who could have lost everything. You know, like a lot of the friends that I have on the streets, and we're out there every single month, even though I'm no longer serving in the capacity that I was serving in, i.e. food, you know, necessities, things of that nature. I'm still out there every month, and I have relationships with people who have experienced a lot of trauma, and that trauma, you know, sent them on a path of addiction through either drugs or alcohol, you know, and they face major stereotypical views. But I think one thing that I'm trying to create awareness on is, how is this any different than the people that may live three doors down from you? Three doors down from you, you may have an alcoholic or someone who's addicted to drugs, but they may have community that can support their addictions, whereas homeless friends are on the streets and they have lost that through broken relationships, through trauma that they've experienced, through trying to get away from someone that they no longer wanted to be around. And so that community aspect is missing for them. But stereotypical views of homelessness are broad. They're back to what you were saying, they want to be out there. And I've got a great story for that. They are addicted to drugs. They have mental health issues. And one of Community of Hope's core values is to break down stereotypical views. And last year we launched Meet Your Neighbor. And so Becky is a video that we did recently. You can find it on YouTube and on our website and in other places. But it's really just showing Becky for the beauty that she is, you know, and she's such a great person. And she's living in our camps right here in Huntsville today. And she doesn't need to be out there. She needs a housing solution. She has income. But that whole campaign is to break down those stereotypical views so that as humans, we can see people, regardless of whether they're housed or not housed, in the same light that you and I can see each other today.
Absolutely. And a large portion of people experiencing homelessness have income. A lot of them have jobs. A lot of them have Social Security income, just not enough to afford housing.
Yeah, I think I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but the average income for houses right now, I think, is like $1,200. The average rent in Huntsville is $1,200. If you're on Social Security and you're making $864 every month, where does that allow you to think about housing in Huntsville at an average rate of $1,200?
Right.
It's impossible. Right. So then that's, you know, back to that story I wanted to tell you about Joe. So Joe doesn't live in Alabama anymore. He lives in North Carolina. But Joe presented this facade that he's good. He wants to be out here. He doesn't need your help.
Right.
He would have like a tomato plant out front and say, look at my tomato plant. And, you know, this is my tent. This is my space. I'm good. I don't need your help. But the more I got to know Joe and breaking down his own concerns about being my friend and exposing too much, you know, revealing too much, the nutshell piece like really started to fall off, and the moral of the story for Joe was that he couldn't afford it. But as a man, he didn't want to tell me that. Why would you want to say that? Why would you want to say, oh, I need your help? He's not going to do that. He was a Marine. So that's one thing that people need to understand, is that when you meet someone that says that they're good, they're probably not good. They just don't want to reveal to you that they're weak.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great point, and I hadn't thought about that, but absolutely. I mean, and it's not just, I mean, there's obviously gendered expectations, right? Mm-hmm. Men are punished for failing to perform masculinity a lot more than women are punished for failing to perform femininity. And one of the expectations of masculinity is that you would not be vulnerable, that you would not be a burden, that you would not need help, that you can take care of yourself and others. But there's also a Southern thing or a conservative thing of like not needing help and not being a burden, which I think is also at play. So when you're speaking to people, just because they say I don't need help doesn't mean that's necessarily how they might feel if it were seen differently to need help.
Agreed.
I think it's interesting as well to think about what homelessness means. So one thing that I think is really interesting when people say these people are choosing homelessness, and going back to the poverty issue, one thing that you notice when you go abroad is you don't see homelessness in poorer nations. You know, when you go to like really poor parts of like South and Central America, and you go to like really poor parts of India, people aren't homeless. Now, they don't have nice homes.
Yeah.
They're not, the safest, most attractive structures you've ever seen, but they're better than tents.
Tents are terrible.
Tents are pretty much the worst thing you could possibly like inhabit.
Yeah.
Besides like literally nothing. It's literally one step above absolutely nothing. And it's illegal to live in anything between a tent. Well, I mean, it's illegal to live in a tent. Let's be real. Homelessness is criminalized. Yeah. But we tolerate tent structures. But if you build something that's anywhere between a tent and a code compliant, zoning approved, perfectly nice, you know, acceptable, community approved, aesthetically pleasing single family home,
yeah,
the city will literally tear it down and force you back into the tent. And so that's why I really brought you on. Like,
yeah,
like, let's really talk about it. Like, why do we have a home? So, and going back to what you said, so you quoted somebody who said housing can never solve homelessness.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't it? But like, you have to really understand, like, the story is like, when you walk with people who's experiencing homelessness, and let me use my friend Tina. Tina has been on the streets forever, and she finally got into housing, which was incredible, and I'm excited for her, but she is struggling. Right. She's struggling because she doesn't have a car. She doesn't have a way to get her medications, so she's not staying on her medications. I actually work with a doctor who's incredible here in Huntsville that goes and takes her, delivers wow. her medication to her door. And not so that she can stay in medication. So Tina's in a house, but she, I mean, barely. And then we've gotten other people into housing too that in parts of the city, you know, and this is back in my frustration days where all of this was mounting to the point where I'm like, okay, enough. We just need to build a community because this is just overkill. But they would move into apartments and the bed bugs would be so terrible that they would prefer to live on the streets versus in a house. Mm-hmm. So back to that whole analogy of housing will never solve homelessness. You can put someone in a house all day long. And I've got another great story about a friend that I moved into Johnson Towers. But if they don't have the support systems that they need, they will bounce every single time. So at the end of the day, if you're building houses for days and days and days, but you don't have that supportive system around it, it's not, I don't see where it's going to work. What is the guy's name that I want to tell you the story about? I'll think of it in a minute. But we moved him into Johnson Towers. He got a housing voucher from the city of Huntsville, which we're excited about. And we moved him in there, and we worked our tails off to get him everything that he needed. Because again, here's another dilemma and barrier. People move into housing, but then what? They don't have a couch. They don't have food. They don't have a toilet brush to clean their toilet with. And some people even struggle with understanding what cleaning is. But he stayed there for about 3 months, and we worked our tails off to get him everything that he needed. My aunt stocked his entire fridge, got him trash bags, sponges to clean with, everything. And he bounced because he didn't know how to care for that space and place. So back to housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. If you have that support system, and some of these folks, I mean, back to stereotypical views of homelessness, sometimes people become homeless when they're 7. And that's hard to think about. Yeah. But at the age of 7, and I have a precious 9-year-old, my 9-year-old does not know how to clean. He doesn't, and I'm working with him on those trades because he needs to learn those things. Right. But a 7-year-old is not going to know how to properly care for food that needs to be stored in a refrigerator or to how to clean a home. And so when you're looking at that 7-year-old who was homelessness and fast forward 50 years and now he's 57, you expect, there's a level of expectation. You're 57, you need to know how to take care of a home, but he doesn't know how to do that. So it's just shattering when you think about people. If you, relationships are the most important. If you know that person, you know what they need, and then you can support them in the way that they need to be supported.
Okay. Thank you for that context. I think that in terms of simply giving someone a home is not going to fix their problems.
Correct.
Completely agreed. Depending on the person.
Right.
So I kind of look at it like, first of all, I want to make a point about community, which is I have written about politics my entire career, starting before I graduated college. And thinking about like what matters. Mm-hmm. And over the past few years, I've really come to believe that if there's one problem that is the highest leverage problem to solve for humanity and for Western countries in particular, it's loneliness. I think community is absolutely everything when it comes to like the Harvard study, right? Where what matters the most in terms of health and happiness and longevity, mm-hmm. it's community, it's connection, it's not being lonely. And so I absolutely think that you can solve a person's material deprivation and they can be worse off if in doing so you sever them from their community. And that's part of what makes me insane about policy is that when you tear down a tent encampment, you're severing that community. Like, those people have formed community.
They have.
It's not ideal.
Yeah.
But it's better than not having that community. And when you say, well, why don't we just ship the homeless people to X, Y, and Z? And why don't they just move out to, you know, whatever far-flung place? Because that's not where their community is. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you raise the rents hundreds and hundreds and, you know, 100% over 5 years, and you displace people out to the county, it's not just bad for them. It's not just bad for the environment, but it's bad for the entire, like, area, because you're severing them from their community.
Totally.
So, completely agreed there. The way I kind of look at it is there are three kinds of people experiencing homelessness.
Okay.
You have people for whom all they need is a place to live. They can afford to live there. Mm-hmm. If you lower the average cost of housing, you eliminate most homelessness. Mm-hmm. There are people then who, even with cheaper market rate housing, are still not going to be able to afford it. Those are the people who need cash assistance. Mm-hmm. And then you have a very small percentage of the population for whom cash assistance and cheaper housing is still not going to be enough. These are people who need workforce development, mental health, addiction, and then a very, very small percentage of the population, even when offered these services, need help getting and staying in them. And so these people need guardianship. Does that comport with your experience?
Yes. And in fact, you know, the way that Community of Hope will be built and structured, it consists of three different types of people, tier one, tier two, tier three. And we can get into all the analytics of how that actually works. But tier one would be that people are somewhat very stable, that they just need that space and they need a high neighbor every now and again and maybe some encouragement, but they already have a job. Maybe they already have a vehicle. They're just experiencing homelessness, you know, for a variety of different reasons. And then tier three, just to kind of fast forward, is really people that need mental health support. They need a lot. They need a lot of love. They need a lot of time, and they need a lot of patience. And most of our systems built within the community don't allow for any of those, but specifically patience. People don't have patience for people to be able to heal. And that's what I love about Community of Hope. Community of Hope is permanent housing. A lot of people have a problem with that because they think, oh, well, homelessness, people need transitional housing, they can transition, you know. And I want to say, well, if you have lost a child and you have become addicted to whatever that is, substance, to deal with that loss, and now you are homeless because you have lost everything due to your addiction, and then you come into a space where in 3 months, I'm telling you, you're going to have to get your act together in 3 months. People start projecting and thinking, oh my gosh, okay, I have 90 days, and now I only have 60 days, and now I only have 30 days. And where's the healing in that conversation? You know, if you have anxiety about the next step, there's no time to really heal. So Community of Hope is permanent supportive housing. We will have that space for people to breathe. I want to call them hair on fire rooms. I've already kind of talked to my board about it, but we get calls 24/7 about people who have their hair on fire in that moment. And I need to be able to figure out what's going on with them without them bouncing around to 100 different agencies to figure out where they can go for support. So we're excited about our efforts. It's different. We're not going to be transitional housing. We don't necessarily believe that everyone's going to be able to transition as society has stemmed, you know, created that word of transitioning to what, from what, you know, and that's hard to tell until you have that relationship.
I love that. And it reminds me of the thing that I think people have a hard time grappling with if they've never experienced it, which is that poverty causes brain damage. Mm. Your brain operates differently on scarcity.
Oh, yeah.
And we've shown this in the lab. We've done observational studies. When you don't have enough of something, your brain starts screaming at you. And it makes you make worse decisions, particularly decisions that are more short term. So when you look at somebody and you say, oh, they're poor, why are they making that decision? Why are they acting like that? Because they're in crisis. Mm-hmm. And if you were in crisis, you would also be making bad decisions.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing that happens to people who are in that situation. So absolutely, like, putting someone in a situation of artificial precarity where they have to worry about where they're going to live in the next 90 days causes them to operate suboptimally.
I couldn't agree more. But I have had like detailed conversations with people, you know, that they'll say, oh, well, you're just creating an environment where people will want to stay. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. Like, we're creating an environment where people can heal and restore. And then once that happens, something miraculous happens next, which is, I feel confident. I feel worthy. I feel like I can take this job. I have a home. I can take a shower. I don't have to smell terrible when I go in for a job interview. I have a neighbor that will help me with a resume. I feel confident enough to be able to take that next step. So just like in Community First Village in Austin, Texas, some people stay because they're in that tier three category, and the trauma that they've had on their lives, it's just where they're at. And we have to love them where they're at and accept them for who they are and not continue to encourage them to be something that they'll never be. But then there's the people who are like, man, I feel so good about what I'm doing in my workforce development on site here. I feel like I can go and get a job now. I feel confident in that. I feel like I can leave this tiny home and this community and fly. And I'm like, that was the turn on for me at Community First Village. I've been out there 5 times. John Meredith, city council president, went out there and met us in August of this past year. And I'm in love with what they're doing because they get down to the level of, I want to know who you are, Kathy. I want to know where you're from. What do you love to do? What do you not love to do? And I want to build a relationship with you so that we can see you get to the next level, whoever that person is that we're talking to. And it's exciting to see that. It's very exciting.
It's so interesting because it's like, okay, we need to threaten people with homelessness and poverty or they won't work. And it's like, well, is that true of you? are you that kind of person?
It's like scolding people to
yeah, and it's
weird.
It's a very negative view of human nature and human behavior. I mean, what we've seen again in the lab and in observational studies is that humans by and large are just remarkably and consistently pro-social. You know, we want to help each other. We want to be fair. We want to give back. We want to be productive. We want to be useful to each other. And I don't know, it's this weird idea that like, okay, we could either spend time and energy ensuring that everyone has what they need to be productive, however you want to define it, members of society, or we can erect systems that ensure that people are constantly afraid mm-hmm. of losing everything, and then that will scare them into acting in the right way. And it's like,
it doesn't work.
It's really, and it's yeah. The thing is, it's more expensive.
It is
to operate the latter system than the former system.
And I think if you look back, like back to my excitement and what we're doing, what others are doing, there's many people that are replicating this sort of model across the United States. But Housing First is failing in a variety of different ways. And how much is our government throwing at Housing First? Not just in Alabama. I mean, see, yes, you agree completely. It's failing because back to that whole housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. It's failing because people think, oh, you know, we'll put this person in this little box and they're just going to be fine. And they're not. They're not fine. So there's a lot of elements to that. But I would love to see all of the money thrown at Housing First into something where it does make sense. And it's really simple. It's really simple stuff.
I completely agree that Housing First is failing. And I completely agree that part of why it's failing is that, I mean, one, how do we know Housing First is failing? Well, within 10 years, the majority of people who are enrolled in and participate in Housing First experience homelessness again. That's a fail. A majority, that's a fail. Another reason that it's failing is that it's extremely expensive. Another thing that we know, or a KPI, a key performance indicator, would be the expense of it. The other thing that, to me, when you talk about, is Housing First a success or a failure? Has it reduced rates of homelessness? Not by one tiny little bit.
No, it's growing exponentially.
Where it's been tried and where it hasn't been tried, it's mm-hmm. growing everywhere. Every growing city, as far as I know, is also experiencing growing rates of homelessness. Except cities that are building a lot more housing. Mm-hmm. And this is the fundamental problem with Housing First, is that Housing First takes units that are already in existence and makes them Housing First units. So there's no increase in net number of units under Housing First. And it costs money to operate Housing First and to take the unit and make it a Housing First unit. So you're spending money, but you're not increasing the net number of new units. So how could it work? Like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, Housing First could work for a percentage of homeless people who just need housing if it involved building a lot more units, but it doesn't. So it's doesn't work and it will never work. Anyway, this is as good a time as any to talk about new units.
Yeah.
And why you guys have not been able to create a plan that involves building. So when we talk about like poverty traps, if you build in the county, which is your plan.
Yeah.
Everyone who works pretty much will need a car.
Mm-hmm.
That is expensive and getting more expensive every day to own and operate a vehicle. It's a huge barrier, right? If you could build in the city, people could use transit, people could walk, people could bike to their jobs.
Yeah.
So they could get employed easier, they could get out of poverty more quickly. It would be better for the environment, it would be better for public health. Just for lots and lots of reasons, it would make way more sense for you guys to be able to build in the city, but you were not legally allowed to.
Yeah, there's a lot, and I mean, I'm going to go back to Austin again. They experienced something very similar. They had a seven-year land battle where even the City Council of Austin extended land to Mobile Loaves and Fishes or Community First Village, and it the Not in My Backyard movement, which is something we can touch on at some point too, but NIMBY became so loud that they had to retract that and say, okay, I'm sorry. I know we were going to gift you this land, but now we're going to take it back because our constituents are not happy and they're, you know, we're not going to get votes. And then we go down the political rabbit hole of nothingness. But same. So we're facing very similar situations. Density is a word that's tossed around pretty heavily in Huntsville. We're housing chronically homeless people. So we're not looking, we will have some density because we'll have people that live on site that are not experiencing homelessness. So, you know, that will exist. But the county is the best place for us because we will not have to face so much adversity and so many barriers as an organization when our hearts are simply set on housing chronic homeless individuals. So Madison County is the answer for us.
So there are two aspects to what can keep someone from being able to build any kind of structure. And this matters to me, again, because it's not just that this community isn't allowed in the city. It's that our zoning ordinance does not allow any kind of naturally affordable housing in at least 70% of the city. It is illegal to build anything other than a single family detached home with a large lot. It's more than 70% of Huntsville. Well, guess what? A single family home with a large lot is expensive. It's expensive to build, it's expensive to inhabit, it's expensive to maintain. It causes sprawl, right? It causes traffic. It causes car dependence. It causes lack of walkability and bikeability. Lawns are expensive to maintain. They're terrible for the environment. Like, yuck. Anyway. Not into them. Yeah. I mean, if you want to live in one, fine, but like, it shouldn't be legally mandated that that's the only thing you can build on that piece of property, especially in a city.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but there's two elements. So there's the zoning element, mm-hmm. which I believe, so like a single room occupancy is a type of housing that is naturally more affordable than even an apartment.
Yeah.
So we're building a lot of apartments right now, but they're not particularly affordable. Well, they're all, you know, entire apartments where you've got the kitchen and the bathroom. That all costs a certain amount of money to build and maintain. Single room occupancy is essentially, it's a kind of like a boarding house, right? So you'd have rooms that people live in, and then you'd have more shared bathrooms and kitchens. So maybe two units would share a kitchen and a bathroom, or maybe a hall would share a kitchen, and then there would be like a few bathrooms sprinkled in, or however it would. But it's a cheaper way to build.
Totally.
It's illegal. It's illegal to build that in Huntsville, which is wild, and why we have a homelessness problem. So there's the zoning barrier,
right?
But then there's the NIMBY barrier, which something can be legal to build, and a developer can say, hey, we've got this plan, this project, it is compliant with zoning, building, everything, but can we build it? And then the neighbors come and say, like, we don't want this. We don't want to live next to this. We don't want these apartments in our backyard. We don't want these SROs in our backyard. We don't want these people nearby.
That's right.
And so my understanding is that Community of Hope is not legal to build. Like, it does not comply with zoning or the zoning ordinance. Is that right?
Yeah, as far as I know. And we have pushed the envelope some. We have great relationships. Like I mentioned, John Meredith came back in August, which was a huge honor. And I appreciate his support and his interest in helping us navigate these waters and find a way. But he, too, struggles with, you know, how to navigate these waters and how to find a way. And so I had presented some zoning and coding ordinances from Salt Lake City, who was doing something very similar, which in a nutshell, her story was like, the mayor was like, I've had enough, you know, like, we've got to do something different. Whatever you can do, make this happen. And so they ended up taking city property that was unused and pushing forward a model very similar to ours. And they too are facing barriers. You know, it's just things that make sense. You know, for me, I'm thinking, okay, from a city perspective, how much money are we spending on HMSE for our homeless community? How much money are we spending on the police department for our homeless community? Our hospitals are overrun with homeless individuals because they have nowhere else to go in time of crisis. We've got fluctuating weather situations where it's either freezing cold and 12 degrees or it's burning hot, you know, and people need that palliative relief and they're not getting it. So we're wearing our city infrastructure out on not addressing this issue. And my number one concern every time is like, guys, this is back to simple. This is super simple. Like, why are we making this overly complicated? And the dollar is really what it boils down to. There's a revenue piece involved in this where, you know, they think about city infrastructure and back to what you're talking about with single dwelling occupancy, like, they want those tax dollars, that revenue to flow through in that capacity. And so, again, we push the envelope. I could be in front of city council for days. In fact, in 2014, I think I told you this, in 2014, there was another girl who tried to do something similar, and she took her tiny home to the city council, and they said not only no, but heck no, and see your way out the door. And that good effort eventually dissolved because of the barriers that we face as organizations trying to do nothing more than good and really solving a lot of the homeless issues that our city is facing, as far as the police and HMSE and our downtown areas being run amok, and how many police are shooing them out of Big Spring Park right now. And you know what I'm saying? Like, why do we make things so complicated?
Yeah, I mean, the average cost to a city, and this does not include all of the costs, but in terms of like some of the more measurable costs, is $50,000 to $100,000 per person experiencing homelessness per year. Mm-hmm. So it's a very expensive problem.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because my understanding is that, like I said, 70% of Huntsville is zoned for single family homes. And yet we're getting all these apartment complexes for high income people. And my understanding is that the developers are buying the lots and then going to planning, zoning, I guess the council. I'm not sure actually how it works, but they're getting the lots rezoned for multifamily. So it would seem like, I mean, your barrier, it sounds like, is the lot sizes are too small, that the zoning ordinance mandates a lot size that's bigger than you your plan.
Yeah, you know, and back to things that I just like avoid, back to where I'm so glad that you guys are not avoiding it. But I avoid it because I view it as a time waster for me. Am I going to sit in a city council meeting and talk for 10 hours about how close a house is to another house when yet you go down South Parkway on the right hand side and I think it's called the Dairy, but their house is, I mean, like you could literally, like me to you, I could give you a salt shaker from my window to your window. So it's already happening in Huntsville, but yet we still get the no. And, you know, I don't want to fight it all day long. I've got other things to do, like house the homeless. I don't want to sit there and be in that litigation, but I'm so grateful that you do, because we need people like you fighting this good fight, because it's such a barrier for us and so many others that want to do similar works.
Absolutely. To me, I just think this is a policy choice,
mm-hmm.
and it's a choice to have a zoning ordinance that mandates a certain kind of artificially expensive home that, again, is bad for a lot of things that you would not want, good for a lot of things you would not want, bad for a lot of things that you would want, bad for society, bad for the city in a lot of ways. And because we have the zoning ordinance in place, that means projects are approved on a project by project basis, which means there's a lot of latitude to say, well, this project that we expect to house high income people, we're going to approve, we're going to allow. And this project that we expect to house lower income people, it doesn't fit. We don't want it. Bye. And the thing is, at the end of the day, it may be that there are more people with more power who want to protect the status quo than people in terms of number and power who want a better city. And that may be the case, but I'm going to talk about it until everyone knows.
Good.
That's what's happening.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly what's happening. And back to Austin, Texas, they experienced that for 7 years. They eventually moved out into Travis County. They can't be inside Austin city limits because of the same barriers. I will say that after, I think a point that I made to John Meredith specifically as we were walking through that community in Austin was, John, let's not let it get to the point where we have to wait this long to get any type of funding or any type of approval. Like, they're already doing it. Travis County just gave Community First Village in Austin, Texas, like $64 million. No strings attached money, which was great because Travis County finally said, oh my gosh, what they're doing is so good. And they're actually getting people off of the streets and people are staying off of the streets and they're living in community. And then they're either going on or those that need to remain. In fact, they're building out 1,900 homes now. And then another group just gifted them more acreage out by the Austin airport so that they can continue to do what they're doing because they're doing it so well. But that's what, again, my point to John is, let us not wait this long before we see Madison County gifting $64 million to Community of Hope, because that $64 million will actually do something instead of just throwing money back at Housing First or throwing money at whatever we're throwing money at right now, because it's not making any sense. My biggest pet peeve is when I see a headline that says $500,000 coming into Madison County for homelessness. And I'm like, where does that go? Where? Does anyone know the answers? And I don't think anyone does yet. And that's okay, but, or not okay, but.
Yeah. And it's tough because we obviously need people to provide services to homeless people experiencing homelessness.
We do.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. And more should go toward that. But the fact that, as far as I can tell, 100% of the dollars given to the problem of homelessness goes to making homelessness less shitty for the people experiencing it, and no dollars are going toward ending homelessness as a thing that happens.
Yeah.
We're maintaining. Wild.
We're maintaining.
We're not maintaining. Homelessness is growing. We're
correct.
Spending more money mm-hmm. to serve more people because more people are falling into and staying into homelessness mm-hmm. because we're not putting any money towards solving the problem.
That's right.
So give to us because we are actually working on solving it.
Yeah.
Give to you.
Yeah.
You are actually working on solving it. And continue giving to services. I'm not saying divert money from services.
Right.
I'm saying in addition to paying for services, let's pay for solutions.
Yeah. And I think that that's an important statement. And I say it all the time because I was just speaking to someone that was talking about blessing bags. Blessing bags, I have a personal relationship with them where I pulled out 45 blessing bags out of one person's tent. And I'm like, okay, this is just a waste of resources because... But then sometimes blessing bags are really important because it could have been the deal breaker for that person who may have been on the verge of saying, you know, I'm going to end my life today or I'm not. And then someone came by and was sweet enough to acknowledge that person. So I don't want to take away from any of those services. They're critically important. Serving hot meals at the camps, being having case management within our community, which we're doing a great job of. There's a lot of case managers out there right now. But the problem is that even if they're working with a case manager and they get to that step of, okay, I'm ready for my keys. I'm ready for my house. I've done all of the steps.
What house?
I have my driver's license. I have this. I have that. I have a job. I have an income. I have a support system. I can pay utility deposits. Oh my gosh, the list gets longer and longer. Where is the house?
Right.
And there's some. I don't want to say that there's not.
Of course.
But it's like a very small percentage of housing availability. And so we've got nonprofits out there saying, hey, we moved 25 people in 2023 into a house. And I'm excited for those 25 people. I don't want to take away from the 25 people that got into the houses. But I'm like, okay, what about the hundreds of other people that
200
also
people
need
fell
housing?
Into homelessness. So,
right. You're adding into the bucket. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm so happy that you're so passionate about it. How can people get involved?
With Community of Hope?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're looking for land, as is everyone. You mentioned the developers earlier. They're out there and they're paying premium dollar for land. So nonprofit, you know, who's wanting to pay our first fundraising goal is $2.5 million, and we actually increased our goal. We were at $1.5 million and we became obsolete because
amazing
as Huntsville grows, you know, those numbers grow, and we could no longer find 50 acres for $1.5 million. So we increased it to $2.5 million. But I called somewhere on South Parkway not too long ago. They have 48 acres and I'm like, yeah, I'm just curious as to how much this 48 acres is. And he's like $9,599,999. I'm like, what? I can't compete. So, but here's what's cool and things that I know. There are people in Huntsville that have land. There are people in Huntsville that have family land. There are people in Huntsville that want to legacy give. This is a great opportunity for naming rights. If that's important to you, we can name a road after you or a house or the mental health facility or whatever that looks like. So there's great opportunities for you to be involved and not only with your financial backing, but your time, talent, and treasure. Like there's treasure being financial, but like there's so many different ways that you can support our community. So we're fundraising. That's really all we're doing at this point. Fundraising starts with fun, right? So it's about connecting with people and letting them know what we're working on, letting them know that we're looking for land in Madison County, and that we're working to raise those dollars to equal that 2.5 so we can pay cash for that property. We're not interested in taking out loans right now because it's a very scary, we're in a very weird place in 2024 with a lot of different conversations about things that are way bigger than us. We're talking about the dollar and where the stability of the country is and all of those things. So we're not going to mess with that as a nonprofit. We want to pay cash for that land. So we're fundraising. That's phase one, is to purchase property, and that's going to happen. I have no doubt. I would not continue these efforts if I felt that it was going to fail. This is going to be a cool place. So communityofhope.org is a great place to find us.
And then you are still doing some direct community work with people experiencing homelessness in the camps.
Yeah. Well, and our partners at Downtown Rescue Mission, which I know you had Keith on early in your series, which Keith
first
is
one.
Awesome. I he love working with Keith. But we are at the Downtown Rescue Mission once a month,
okay.
And we're working with women who are experiencing homelessness. They're either coming in the emergency shelter side or they are staying there. And we're paying them an hourly wage to work and hang out with us. And we're handcrafting goods like earrings and necklaces. And so those women are finding dignity and worth. And we're spending one-on-one time with them. And then we're mailing those earrings out to anyone in the community that's interested in getting that, which is super cool. And then we're in the camps once a month also. We just go out to continue to build relationships. I don't take stuff anymore. I used to take stuff. And sometimes I'll still take stuff. And stuff meaning chapstick and blankets and tents and all of the stuff that comes with homelessness. I will take it if you gift it to me to take out there, but I'm not seeking those types of things anymore. I'm really just focused on who is out there, how long have they been out there, do I know them, do I know their name, how do I get to know them.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Awesome. And for us, we are building our list of people who care about this, so sign up for our email newsletter. Probably the best way right now is just to go to HuntsvilleNewLiberals.com.
Or Housing for Huntsvillians.
There's a little form there. And then, we're going to start going to city council meetings and planning commission meetings and learning more about the process and how to streamline abundant, affordable housing to end homelessness in Huntsville and surrounding areas.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
Me too.
It's hard work though. So
yeah,
it takes a lot of hard work and effort. And let us not be one of those organizations that sizzle out, you know, because of adversity, because it's there and we will continue to face it. But I'm excited about what you guys are doing.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm excited about what you guys are doing. I think that I am just motivated by the belief that there is no higher leverage thing to do in politics than to work at the most local level possible.
Couldn't agree more.
And that there is no higher leverage thing our city could do to improve every aspect of our citizens' lives, and disproportionately our citizens who are more marginalized, than to build a lot more abundant, dense housing.
Yep, I agree.
Awesome. Thank you again for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in.